So I think that by studying the history of Zionism, we can convince people. But I think that just denouncing it without explanation isn't that helpful.
As you study that history, you learn that people, when the country of Israel was formed, people like Albert Einstein said, I don't want anything to do with Zionism. I won't be the head of the country, as you've asked, and so forth. Well, in any event, this is Jim Lafferty, along with my co-host Michael Smith, and we're interviewing at the moment Professor Alan Wald from the University of Michigan. Well, Alan Wald, sadly, we are just about out of time, but I would like to hear any brief final thoughts you have on the topic we've been talking about today. And most assuredly, please let our listeners know where they can find some of your books and writings, websites, whatever you might direct them to that would be helpful in them understanding the topic we've been discussing today.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing I would like to conclude by saying is we do need to organize and fight back. Collective action is the answer. Individuals can play a certain kind of role, but the political movement on the left has changed a lot since the new millennium with social media and so on. And we do see a lot of people participating simply by tweets and by Instagram and also, you know, by snarky remarks. And so I think we need national organizations that can unify people around clear political demands, and the demand should be against the U.S. government. And also on institutions with investments in the Israeli state. And of course, the demand should be to immediately stop funding and work for a permanent ceasefire and a just solution. I'm certainly not against people showing solidarity with Palestine and, you know, carrying Palestine flags and stuff like that. But the movement itself has to make demands on the government. And we need to promote also things like the BDS within that framework, the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Movement. And we have to carry out educational activities about what is anti-Semitism really, and then the fact that it's growing on the right is the problem. And we have to train people to clearly and competently explain to the public what is Zionism, not just shout slogans. I think we also need to have a clearinghouse of lawyers that can defend the victims of repression and organize defense committees nationally and unite people. I think Palestine Legal and the ACLU are doing some of this, but I haven't really seen it on a local level, but I haven't really seen a national effort. Then there's the global dimension. I mean, there are people in different countries with the same kinds of concerns. We have to figure out ways to link up to these movements in other countries. I've been on a few Zoom meetings with people in England and Western Europe, but I think there has to be a lot more of that. And on the other hand, we have to discipline ourselves. It's not helpful for people to do individually disruptive things. I mean, sometimes you can disrupt in a clever way. And of course, there are circumstances where, like, if, you know, Netanyahu were to come to the United States, yeah, you'd want to disrupt that. But some of these small-scale disruptions are not helpful. And we know that just one or two people acting poorly or with a terrible slogan, you know, like we need more October 7th against Israel or something, you know, Israel deserves October 7th. I mean, that's not very helpful.
I appreciate what you've just said. Would you please then quickly tell us where people can learn more about this, find your books, find your writings and so forth?
Well, I've been writing articles for the Journal Against the Current, which gets circulated. They appear on Portside. I said some were just published by the British Labour Party, the Jews in the Labour Party and stuff like that. I mean, they circulate on the internet. If you look up the topic and the name, you know, I tend to rely on 972, on Al Jazeera. This is good stuff in the London Review of Books. I like Adam Schatz's writings. There's a lot of good stuff out there. And of course, the Rashid Khalidi's books are terrific. There are a number of Palestinian scholars who are doing great stuff on this.
Thank you, Alan Wald, for being with us today here on Law and Disorder. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, to listen to your ideas and your views, and we encourage our audience to follow up with as you have suggested.
Okay, thanks. Glad to talk to you guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Department of Homeland Security was created in 2002. Trump has appointed Kristi Neer, the governor of South Dakota, to be its new head. The DHS has consolidated previously separated departments and brought into a single sprawling entity 22 pre-existing agencies. It became the nation's third largest government department. Today it has a budget over $100 billion and employs 250,000 people. Every danger is now conceived as a threat to, quote, homeland security. As governor, Neer sent South Dakota National Guard troops to Texas 8 times to fight what she called the Biden border crisis. Trump said, quote, she'll work closely with border czar Tom Holman to secure the border and will guarantee that our American homeland is secure from our adversaries, end quote. Neer said, quote, I look forward to working with border czar Tom Holman to make America safe again. With Donald Trump, we'll secure the border and restore safety to American communities so that families will again have an opportunity to pursue the American dream, end quote. In 2017, she supported the Trump travel ban on Muslims. In 2021, she opposed Afghan refugees coming into South Dakota. In her memoir, she wrote about how she shot and killed her 14-month-old dog, Cricket, because he was not a good hunter. Today, we interview the Philadelphia-based writer Arun Khanani, who moved from London to the U.S. in 2010. He has recently co-authored the pamphlet Homeland Security, Myths and Monsters. His books include What is Anti-Racism and Why It Means Anti-Capitalism. Also, he's written The Muslims Are Coming, and the third book he's recently written is called The End of Tolerance. A former editor of the journal Race and Class, Arun has been described by the Guardian newspaper as, quote, one of Britain's best political writers. Arun Khanani, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's nice to have you. We're going to talk about the Department of Homeland Security today. Where did the Department of Homeland Security come from? What does it consist of? And what does it do?
Well, one of the reasons for us putting out this pamphlet is that a lot of people forget how the Department of Homeland Security actually came into existence in the early phase of the war on terror after 9/11. So the pamphlet is, in fact, a graphic booklet with amazing illustrations by the artist Anuj Shrestha, and it's co-authored with Mizu Ozeki, who also co-edited the longer book it's based on called Resisting Borders and Technologies of Violence, which was published by Haymarket this year. But the Department of Homeland Security was founded in November 2002 amidst that atmosphere of kind of paranoia and vengeance in the war on terror. It brought together three different issues that until then had been seen as separate: immigration control, counterterrorism, and emergency management. And it basically placed them all under the heading of this new term, Homeland Security, a newly invented word, that phrase that no one had really used before then. When it was created, it was the only new government department that, you know, it's actually still the only new government department that's been created this century. It absorbed 22 pre-existing agencies into this kind of single sprawling entity, now the third largest government department. And soon enough, all kinds of other issues were sort of absorbed into it. If you look at the website now for the Department of Homeland Security, the things it lists as working on, apart from the three main headings that I already mentioned, cybersecurity, identity theft, policing of protests, school shootings, climate change adaptation, white supremacy, migrant labor exploitation, all these things get absorbed into it, and all of them get given this kind of homeland security framing. It has a budget of $100 billion. It employs 250,000 people. What is the homeland? What is this thing that is being secured? Well, the 9/11 Commission defined the American homeland as the entire planet. So you get a sense of the reach of this department. Its aspiration is to turn every issue into a matter of national security and apply that logic across the whole world. When you examine closely what homeland security means here, you realize it means security for the corporations to roam the world accumulating profits, not security for ordinary people. The greatest safety threats that we face are things like climate change, things like pandemics, things like the social breakdown resulting from our failed economic system. And the DHS does nothing, of course, to address those dangers.
Arun, President-elect Trump has now nominated the person he wants to see running the Department of Homeland Security, Kristi Neer. What can you tell us about her background, her political background and such, and what might we expect from her as the head of the department?
Well, she has sided with fossil fuel corporations against protesters. She has supported the Islamophobic Muslim ban from the Trump 1 administration. She's opposed to refugees arriving in South Dakota, where she's been the governor. She said that there is an invasion coming over the southern border of the United States. So she has all the qualifications for the job of heading up the Department of Homeland Security. As a congresswoman and then South Dakota governor, she worked with the energy company TransCanada to get legislation passed in 2019 to clamp down on people who were protesting against the Keystone XL pipeline. You remember the movement there involving indigenous people especially. The great illustration of how the whole notion of homeland security works. There's no greater danger to our security than the fossil fuel corporations who are destroying our planet, and yet she works to protect those very corporations from any challenge.
Arun, Trump got himself elected scapegoating undocumented immigrants as if they were the cause of a lot of our troubles. He has promised that on day one, he'll institute massive roundups, incarcerations, and deportations. Talk about the Department of Homeland Security's role in all of this.
Yeah, well, you know, things are moving very fast. We don't know exactly what to expect, but I think we should take Trump at his word and plan and anticipate for a very aggressive attempt at mass deportations as soon as he takes office in January, and the agency that he will turn to implement that primarily is this Department of Homeland Security, with the vast resources that have been pumped into it since 2002 by both Republicans and Democrats. That's the kind of bipartisan infrastructure that is now available to the Trump administration to perform what, you know, could be a form of ethnic cleansing, right? Attempting to remove people on the basis of their ethnicity. Let's not forget that over the last four years, the DHS has already forced hundreds of thousands of people out of the United States against their will in the name of border control. When the Department of Homeland Security was created, it also included the creation of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Its powers had been built up through the 80s and 90s to be able to surveil, to detain and deport people. Every year, ICE arrests hundreds of thousands of people. So that's already happening. You know, ICE raids in people's homes, workplaces and neighborhoods. ICE is also a massive surveillance operation. You know, there's billions of dollars in contracts with tech corporations to gather and process data. There's something called the HART biometrics database that is central to that. Every fingerprint taken in every police precinct gets shared with the Department of Homeland Security. So in the name of protecting borders, we have this massive surveillance operation that affects all of us. All of that infrastructure is now part of the machinery that Trump can draw on. The existence of this whole attempt to surveil and round up people through ICE, through the Department of Homeland Security, that's been there for decades now, has constantly, over that time, sent out this message, you know, that immigrants are these dangerous criminals, these terrorists who need to be treated with suspicion and ultimately with the violence of a deportation. And so that's all helped to create the atmosphere in which Trump's anti-immigrant politics has been successful and now leads to a situation where millions of undocumented people are living in fear that the government will force them out of their homes, separate them from their children, and transport them away for no other reason than their status.
Well, Arun Khandani, you've already described to us just how vast not only the resources but the reach, the mandate, if you will, of the Department of Homeland Security. Is that why you refer to it as a monster?
Yeah, it's the sheer size of it, you know, the way it absorbs all these disparate issues that seemingly have nothing to do with each other and merges them under this single heading of Homeland Security and transforms them into its own image of Homeland Security. The way it spreads its footprint around the world, the Department of Homeland Security spends a lot of resources to pressure other countries, especially in Latin America, to collaborate in its kind of global policing mission, to share data, surveillance, to construct infrastructures for controlling migration. So, you know, Mexico has been paid billions of dollars to police its southern border by the Department of Homeland Security. So now you have this vast infrastructure of immigration control in Mexico itself that's been built at the behest of the US. And then when you look at the way that with Homeland Security, when one security threat becomes less salient in the public mind. So, you know, with the war on terror, that's kind of receded somewhat in the last few years as a theme of kind of public fear. There's always new threats that come in to replace the ones that have faded away. So it's this kind of constant regeneration of fear. We see the Department of Homeland Security like the Hydra monster from Greek mythology. So it has these multiple heads. When you cut off one head, another grows in its place, and it's constantly regenerating itself.
Talk about, please, the rejection by the Trumpers of any obligation of society to protect the vulnerable as embodied by the campaign against undocumented people in the USA.
Well, I think if we're going to understand something of how Trump has been able to get elected for a second time, we need to get quite deep into essentially like what it's felt like, I think, to be in the world over the last decade or two. And if you think back to the 1990s, for example, this kind of heyday of, you know, what people call neoliberalism coming to dominance in the United States, where we were told that, you know, if we're all individuals competing with each other, we acquire resources through getting a good job, getting into student debt to be able to get a good job. And then, you know, we should be able as individuals to command the pleasures that the marketplace has to offer. And that's the way that society is organized. Well, since the 2008 financial crisis, only a wealthy minority have been able to live like that. That idea of what American society should be like has been in crisis since then. That crisis was exacerbated by COVID, because COVID was a reminder that we're not actually sovereign individuals. We're bound up in all kinds of relationships to each other that we depend on. And so I think all of these kind of events, the financial crisis, the kind of the pandemic, signaled to us that we are highly dependent on the state and highly dependent on society. These things that neoliberal ideology tried to tell us were just nothing but market transactions. And so to the neoliberal mindset, there's been this kind of return of the social that's been deeply shocking. And I think the far right has responded to that very effectively by presenting this sense that we're being forced to return to the social by saying, you know, here's a fantasy you can live out of getting back your individual sovereignty through the kind of nihilistic pleasures of racial and gender domination, all that stuff they talk about, you know, the anti-woke crusade that they're engaged in, is centered on that. And so they're presenting the return of the social as this kind of unwelcome claim on your willingness to care about other groups. They're saying, you know what, you don't need to care. Those obligations to those needier than you, you don't need to worry about them. And the refugee is, of course, the neediest, right? The person who's literally been forced to leave their community, their home, and and arrives in your country with nothing. You know, that's the ultimate symbol to be rejected for the far right, because that symbolizes precisely this fear that maybe we do have social obligations to each other. And so I think this is the key to it, that this kind of neo-fascism draws its sustenance from the neoliberal idea that we should reject social obligations, even as it is, you know, it thrives in the debris of a neoliberal culture, right? That where that belief is threatened, and that's really the power of the MAGA movement, I think.
Arun, you talk about and write about the role of race and how it's a dominant and a manifest role that explains really the expansion of border infrastructure, military spending, the rise in police and budgets, and the building of more and more prisons. You argue that all of this really is justified by presenting, or attempted to be justified, I should say, by presenting Black, Muslim, and migrant cultures as by their very nature deficient. Talk to us about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look at, like, why do borders exist, right? And we've seen the kind of infrastructure of borders, you know, the walls, the surveillance, the legislative powers, you know, all of that really has expanded dramatically since the 1970s. Unrecognizable if you think about how immigration was policed in the 1970s compared to now. And so that border infrastructure has expanded hand in hand with the kind of neoliberal form of capitalism that has existed over that period. The reason that we have borders, you know, I think is ultimately to do with the need to maintain a kind of global apartheid, a kind of global racial division of labor. If you look at the US-Mexico border, you know, the wage paid to a worker in manufacturing work on the US side of the border in Texas is five times what it is for the same job on the Mexican side of the border. So what that border enables is for a corporation to be able to move from the US side of the border to the Mexican side of the border and suddenly have a dramatic saving in its labor costs and therefore increase its profits. And the border makes that possible. So a lot of people on the left think that ultimately capitalists want to get rid of borders, but actually borders are very functional to corporate profits. At the same time, by creating that border, it creates an undocumented workforce within the United States that can be more heavily exploited than the rest of the working class within the US because it's undocumented and therefore subject to heavier policing and more easily controlled. And so, you know, in both those ways, I think borders are highly functional to global capitalism. Alongside that, you have the massive expansion of policing powers, the mass incarceration. You have the massive expansion of the US military over the same period. And I think all of those are in different ways, also ways that racial capitalism organizes the division of the world's populations, right? And the way it justifies that is through these ideas that there's something about Black culture that makes it more dangerous. There's something about Muslim culture that makes it especially predisposed to terrorism. There's something about the cultures of migrants that make them more prone to crime and disruption and so on, right? And so this kind of language becomes the way that it's justified. But what really drives it is these the need to manage a particular form of capitalism. You know, these infrastructures of racist policing, the military, the border, the carceral violence, they coexist with a certain language of cultural diversity. You know, so over the same time, we sort of have this language of celebrating cultural diversity, celebrating racial inclusion and so on. But in the end, those infrastructures end up undermining those appeals to tolerance and diversity and so on that liberals tend to make. And they act as charging stations for fascist movements, right? They give, you know, the existence of the borders, the existence of mass incarceration, of the military and so on, give fascist movements a kind of constant source of political energy they can absorb. So the war on terror, for example, you know, which again, enthusiastically supported both by Republicans and Democrats, was the seed from which you got a new crop of fascist movements in Europe claiming to oppose Islamization. It was the seed from which US support for Netanyahu has been cultivated. The war on terror supplied the building blocks for Trump's first presidential campaign. You remember, you know, he started out politically talking about how Obama was a secret Muslim and this kind of conspiracy theory about Obama. And then he moved on a couple of years later to the Muslim ban. The whole of his initial entry into being a viable presidential candidate was about Islamophobia. What Trump is about the war on terror coming home. The racism of the war on terror deployed abroad, then re-entering the United States in the form of anti-Muslim racism.
Yeah, that's a profound thought, Arun. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. I'm here with Attorney Jim Lafferty. I'm Michael Smith. We're speaking with Arun Kanati, who's just written Homeland Security, Myths and Monsters. It's co-written with Maizu Izeki, and it's illustrated by Andrew Shestra. It's a wonderful pamphlet. I urge you all to get it. Homeland Security, Myths and Monsters. Arun, how do we build power outside of the elections? We got Trump with the elections. What do we do outside of the elections?
I think the challenge we have at the moment is that we have had decades now of a neoliberal culture that has told us that we are individuals above all else. And we have buried the kind of collective values that animated the mass movements of a century ago, let's say. So we need to go back to scratch, back to basics, and start to demonstrate in practice that simple truth that as human beings, we can come together as equals and participate in jointly shaping our destiny through our social and political institutions. Like that experience of participating collectively as equals in shaping something is such a rare experience in a neoliberal era. But without it, we can't really get ourselves off the ground to build the kind of larger mass movements that we need, the kind of organizations that we need to be able to fight back against both the kind of neoliberal version of capitalism and the new kind of neo-fascist version of capitalism that might be emerging. And so, you know, what we need to be involved in an organization. We need to work with other people. We need to make those relationships meaningful. We need to seek changes at whatever level we can, which might be quite small at this point. It might be just in a locality. It might be at the city level rather than at state or federal level. But we need to have that experience of some kind of wins that we achieve collectively. And Maurice Bishop, the leader of the Grenada Revolution, said that organization is our greatest weapon. And in fact, it's our only weapon, but it's the only weapon we need. It can be just 30 people coming together. There's a kind of power in that we need to rediscover.
Well, Arun, we are now getting short of time, sadly, but I guess the question then on our minds is, and should be on everyone's mind really always, I suppose, is what kind of a culture do we really need? Where do you find the faith in the kind of culture you think we need? What kind of values do we need? Your newsletter, you quote a description of values and how we need to restore loyalty, comradeship, generosity, a sense of community, and the like. Talk to us a bit about that. What is needed in order to overcome these divisions, if you will, and have a kind of shattered, scattered culture that we have today in this country?
In that newsletter, I draw on the Sri Lankan writer Sivanandan, who I think describes this very well. And he talks about how we need unity, and unity is not something that you just discover, you know, through a shared identity or a shared class position or something like that. It's something that you have to forge, and you have to forge it again and again and again. And you do that through loyalty, through finding something in other people's struggles that connects with your own, what he calls all the great and simple things that make us human. And I find, you know, that's where my faith comes from, even in these darkest of times. It, you know, is what I know to be true of human beings, that if we live lives that are only about competition and domination, ultimately that's unrewarding. That doesn't satisfy the soul in the way that genuine human connection does. Socialism is nothing if it's not the organization of society to reflect our human need for being together. That's in the end the bedrock upon which everything else that we need to do can be built.
To that I say amen. It's been wonderful having you on Law and Disorder. Jim and I, thank you. We want to ask you one final thing. How can people follow your work? How can they get your newsletter?
The easiest way is just to go to my website, which is mylastname.org. So that's KUNDNANI.org. And there'll be a pop-up on there for people to sign up.
Thank you very much, Arun. It's been a real pleasure for Jim and I to be able to talk to you today. You take it easy.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we begin by interviewing constitutional law scholar Professor Marjorie Cohen about the likely impact of some recent and shockingly conservative U.S. Supreme Court rulings.
Professor Cohen also describes some of the radical proposals contained in the now much-discussed Project 2025 and what it would mean for the lives of most Americans if we were under a new Trump administration. Now on Law and Disorder, instead of the big picture, we look at opposition to Israel's war in Gaza from a very singular and very personal point of view.
We'll do so by talking with Larry Hebert, a 26-year-old U.S. Air Force airman, about his protest and hunger strike in opposition to that war.
Stay with us.
Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
The U.S. Constitution created three branches of the federal government to serve as a check on one another. In particular, the judiciary was intended to ensure that the actions of the executive and legislative branches did not violate the Constitution. But what happens when the Supreme Court is in the grip of a highly partisan, result-oriented supermajority, half of whom were appointed by a president who has been convicted of 34 felonies and faces 57 more felony charges in three different criminal prosecutions, but claims absolute immunity for whatever he did while in office? And on top of that, this ex-president, Donald Trump, is a nominee for president of the United States and has promised to terminate the Constitution. Meanwhile, in an almost 1,000-page blueprint entitled Project 2025, Mandate for Leadership, The Conservative Promise, a group of conservative organizations spearheaded by the Heritage Foundation has laid out a detailed plan under which the president would acquire almost dictatorial power over the entire federal government. To discuss the Supreme Court, Project 2025, and how we can fight back, we've turned to an expert who is no stranger to Law and Disorder, Marjorie Cohen. She was a co-host of Law and Disorder for 2.5 years and has been a guest several times. Marjorie is a professor of law emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, former president of the National Lawyers Guild, and is also dean of the People's Academy of International Law and a member of the Bureau of the International Association of Democratic Lawyers. She writes frequent articles about the Supreme Court and other topics for Truth Out. Marjorie, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Steve and Jim.
Marjorie, since former President Donald Trump appointed three right-wingers to the Supreme Court, thereby solidifying a six-person conservative supermajority, the court has issued several reactionary rulings. What do you consider the most egregious recent rulings of the Supreme Court, and why do you think they pose a threat to our constitutional democracy?
Well, Steve, I have to say it's hard to whittle down what the worst are because there are so many terrible ones. But of course, last term, the Supreme Court overruled the Roe v. Wade decision in Dobbs and held there's no constitutional right to abortion. Now, they wrote that nothing in the opinion should cast doubt on precedents that don't concern abortion, but the dissenters were not convinced. They said no one should be confident that this majority is done with its work. And the right to abortion enshrined in Roe is part of the same constitutional fabric as the rights to contraception and same-sex marriage and intimacy. And they wrote, either the mass of the majority's opinion is hypocrisy or additional constitutional rights are under threat. It's one or the other. Well, Clarence Thomas wrote in his concurrence that the court should reconsider the right to contraception, to same-sex sexual conduct, and the right to same-sex marriage. Then we have a 6-3 ruling with the reactionary supermajority of the court ruling in Department of State versus Munoz, basically that U.S. citizens have no constitutional right to have their non-citizen spouses enter the U.S., so the government doesn't have to give a reason for excluding them, and that places the right to marriage equality squarely on the chopping block. Then we have City of Grants Pass, Oregon versus Johnson, another 6-3 atrocity, where the Supreme Court upheld ordinances in a southwest Oregon city that prohibit people who are homeless from using blankets, pillows, or cardboard boxes for protection from the elements while sleeping within the city limits. And Sotomayor wrote the dissent on behalf of her and Kagan and Jackson that this leaves the most vulnerable in our society with an impossible choice, either stay awake or be arrested. Then the six reactionary members of the court put the final nail in the coffin of the Chevron case, which dramatically curtailed the part of federal agencies to interpret the statutes they administer. The court ruled that courts should provide their own interpretations of ambiguous statutes, and this decision will imperil the rights of workers and consumers and threaten the environment and our health and safety, all while providing a boon to corporations. Courts have used this Chevron deference to uphold a National Labor Relations Board decision that certain workers constitute employees entitled to the protection of the National Labor Relations Act, to affirm an EPA rule that required states to reduce emissions from power plants, to sustain a Department of Labor interpretation of the Black Lung Benefits Act to allow coal miners with black lung disease to get compensation, and accept the EPA's revised regulations under the Toxic Substances Control Act to provide enhanced protection from lead paint exposure. Now corporations will take aim at labor regulations that protect workers. Banks and financial services companies will weaken consumer protections, and the fossil fuel industry will resist regulations that impact their bottom line. Could affect the way insurance is administered by Medicare, Medicaid, and the Affordable Care Act. And perhaps the most shocking decision was the very recent Trump versus U.S., where the six-member supermajority basically held that U.S. presidents are now kings. Henceforth, a president will have absolute immunity from prosecution for official acts done in the course of carrying out his constitutional powers or implementing a federal statute. And that means, well, Roberts, John Roberts, who wrote the majority opinion, he's the chief, said that the president is absolutely immune from criminal prosecution for conduct within his exclusive sphere of constitutional authority. That includes commanding the armed forces, granting pardons, appointing ambassadors and members of the Supreme Court, overseeing international diplomacy and intelligence gathering, terrorism, trade, and immigration. There is no immunity for unofficial acts, but the majority admitted that it's hard to distinguish official from unofficial acts. So Sotomayor wrote in her dissent on behalf of the three liberals, the court effectively creates a law-free zone around the president. It will lie about like a loaded weapon for any president to use for their own political gain or financial interests, with knowledge that they're inoculated from criminal liability. She wrote that when a president uses his official powers in any way, he'll be immune from criminal prosecution. And then she noted, quote, orders the Navy SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power? immune, takes a bribe in exchange for pardon, immune, 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 immune. And they also did away with affirmative action and on and on, Steve.
Well, Marjorie, Jim Lafferty, good morning to you. Takes your breath away what you've already recited for us, and this is not the end, is it? Because you've also studied Project 2025, which Steve mentioned in his introduction. Tell us, therefore, what you've learned, and in particular, what you've learned in terms of what it has to say about what we might expect from the Supreme Court if Project 2025 does, in fact, become the agenda.
Yes, and I should say, Jim, that Donald Trump, because there's been so much negative publicity about Project 2025, Donald Trump is trying to distance himself from it, saying, oh, I don't even know what it says, although he was intimately involved in the development of it. Basically, Project 2025 is a 920-page blueprint for a second Trump administration. It will target reproductive health care, efforts to remediate the climate crisis, immigrants, unions, civil rights for LGBTQ plus people, and administrative agencies that protect our health and safety. It's sponsored by more than 100 reactionary groups and spearheaded by over a dozen former Trump officials. Now, Trump's former budget director, Russell Vought, who wrote one section of this Project 2025, wrote, quote, "The next administration will face a significant challenge in unwinding policies and procedures that are used to advance radical gender, racial, and equity initiatives under the banner of science." Similarly, the Biden administration's climate fanaticism will need a whole-of-government unwinding, unquote. So they're taking direct aim at the climate change measures to prevent climate change or to halt it. The four main prongs of this Project 2025 blueprint are, first, restoring the family as the centerpiece of American life. Second, dismantling the administrative state. Third, defending U.S. sovereignty, borders, and bounty. And fourth, securing our God-given individual rights to live freely. So, of course, the Supreme Court, as I said, just overruled Chevron deference, which means now that it's going to be in the hands of the court to determine our protection of health and safety. Courts that Trump has systematically packed with right-wingers and would continue to do so in a second term. So Project 2025 would have Trump reinstitute his so-called Schedule F, which Biden eliminated. That would reclassify 50,000 of the 2 million merit-based civil service employees as political appointees who serve at the pleasure of the president without civil service protection. And basically, there'd be a massive exodus of competence. Scientific research on nuclear power, for example, would be done by incompetence. Project 2025 would strictly limit access to abortion. And Congress wouldn't have to make abortion medication unlawful because Trump's FDA could just withdraw its approval of the drug. Project 2025 advocates the creation of a Department of Life to further the health and well-being of all Americans from conception to natural death. Of course, anti-assisted suicide, anti-abortion. The new administration would explicitly state that abortion does not constitute health care, and Planned Parenthood would be prohibited from receiving Medicaid funds. Project 2025 would have Trump abolish the Department of Education, which he's been spouting now recently during the campaign. And his right-hand man Vought called the Department of Education the Department of Critical Race Theory. Project 2025 says, quote, "The noxious tenets of critical race theory and gender ideology should be excised from curricula in every public school in the country." Project 2025 would abolish Head Start, the child development program that helps break the cycle of poverty by assisting preschool children of low-income families. It would fund private school vouchers and ban all curricula that teach about slavery, and it would prohibit non-citizens from living in federally assisted housing and oppose any efforts to weaken single-family zoning. So Project 2025, right, read, the next conservative president must make the institutions of American civil society hard targets for woke cultural warriors. This starts with deleting the terms sexual orientation and gender identity, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and in parentheses, DEI. They would delete gender, gender equality, gender equity, gender awareness, gender sensitive, abortion, reproductive health, reproductive rights, and any other term used to deprive Americans of their First Amendment rights out of every federal rule, agency regulation, contract, grant regulation, and piece of legislation that exists. Under Project 2025, Trump would carry out mass deportations of undocumented immigrants. He's already said he'd do that. Deploy active duty military personnel and the National Guard to police the border and complete construction of his border wall. When the Attorney General issues a warrant for an undocumented immigrant, the current law says the immigrant may be arrested and detained. This blueprint would change may to must and require arrest and detention. A Project 2025 recommends eliminating all initiatives to combat climate change, including dismantling the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which tracks hurricanes. It would eliminate offices in the Department of Energy dedicated to renewable energy and climate and energy research. And finally, it would slash the corporate tax rate and the capital gains tax to benefit wealthy Americans. It would tax employers on workplace benefits that exceed $12,000 per worker annually, which would lead to employers cutting back on benefits, including family health insurance. More than 15 million workers would see their benefits taxed under Project 2025. And finally, Project 2025 doesn't recommend any reforms to the Supreme Court. Why not? Because the right-wing extremists have already taken over the court.
My goodness, Marjorie, listening to you, there is such a dangerous synergy between what the Supreme Court has already done in laying the groundwork for this powerful executive branch and then the Project 2025 saying the quiet part out loud of exactly what this administration would do. The Supreme Court can be the last word on some of these issues unless there are reforms. And Joe Biden has proposed and Kamala Harris has endorsed three reforms for the Supreme Court. And we want to spend some time talking about those. First, he favors term limits for members of the high court. What exactly does he recommend? What does the Constitution say about that? And how feasible is his proposal?
Well, on July the 29th, the White House issued a release that said term limits would help ensure that the court's membership changes with some regularity, make timing for court nominations more predictable and less arbitrary, and reduce the chance that any single presidency imposes undue influence for generations to come. And I should say, Steve, that as we all know, Trump installed three radical right-wingers on the court to constitute the six-member supermajority that we have now, more than any in recent memory, more nominations than any president in recent memory. So under Biden's proposal for term limits, the president would appoint a member to the Supreme Court every 2 years, and that member would spend 18 years in active service on the high court. Some legal scholars, such as Berkeley Law Dean Erwin Chemerinsky, have said that current members of the Supreme Court may serve more than 30 years. That's too much power for too long in one person's hand. But he contends that term limits would necessitate a constitutional amendment because Article 3, Section 1 of the Constitution says the judges both of the supreme and inferior courts shall hold their offices during good behavior, unquote. Congressional Republicans would oppose amending the Constitution to create term limits, and the amendment process is unwieldy and time-consuming. Constitutional amendments require a request by two-thirds of both houses of Congress or two-thirds of the states at a constitutional convention. Then, three-quarters of the state legislatures or three-quarters of conventions convened in each state have to agree to ratify the amendment. But several prominent constitutional scholars disagree with Chemerinsky. For example, the Brennan Center for Justice wrote a comprehensive report that said that 18-year active term limits for members of the court is consistent with the Constitution's text and structure and with the ways in which Congress has long regulated the court, including the existing system of senior judges. And 50 constitutional law professors propose that Congress pass a statute to enact term limits for members of the Supreme Court. Even assuming that term limits could be enacted without a constitutional amendment, the currently hopelessly polarized Congress is unlikely to enact that legislation anytime soon. There are two bills pending, one in the House and one in the Senate, that I should mention. H.R. 5566, pending in the House, which has, last time I checked, 49 co-sponsors. H.R. 5566 is called the Term Act. It would allow presidents to appoint one member of the court every 2 years, and for that member to spend 18 years in active service. It would also require current members of the court to assume senior status and as regularly appointed members receive their commissions. In the Senate, we have S-3096 with nine co-sponsors, and S-3096 would permit presidents to appoint a member of the Supreme Court every 2 years, but allow only the nine most recently appointed members or those appointed in the last 18 years to hear cases from the Federal Appeals Court, which is the bulk of the High Court's docket. Members appointed earlier would be limited to hearing cases over which the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, that is like disputes between states. They could also serve as alternates for appellate jurisdiction. Appellate jurisdiction is when the court reviews decisions by lower courts. But the bill wouldn't take effect until the next presidential term after it becomes law. It would preserve life tenure for Supreme Court members by allowing them to continue to hear original jurisdiction cases and exercise other powers after 18 years. Now, let's assume that Congress did pass a term limit statute for the Supreme Court, which is highly unlikely. But let's assume that the High Court did. There's a real risk that that same Supreme Court would strike it down and say, oh, it requires a constitutional amendment.
Marjorie, I have a hunch how you're going to evaluate another proposal, the second proposal that President Biden made in this regard. He proposed, of course, no one is above the law amendment to the U.S. Constitution. But as I say, based on what you've just said to Steve's question, what do you think the chances would be of such an amendment being adopted?
Slim to none. This would be the no one is above the law amendment would reverse the frightening Supreme Court decision in Trump v. U.S., which essentially says the president's a king above the law. You know, absolute immunity for core official acts, presumptive immunity for other official acts. So the president would have absolute immunity for official acts in exercising his constitutional powers or implementing a federal statute. Presumptive immunity for acts committed in the outer perimeter of his official responsibility, whatever that means. The proposed amendment, very briefly, would state that the Constitution does not confer immunity from federal criminal indictment, trial, conviction, or sentencing for former presidents. And there's little chance of such a constitutional amendment for the same reasons that I cited for the term limits statute.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. Today our guest is Marjorie Cohn. We are joined by Jim Lafferty, and I'm Steve Rohde. Marjorie, the third proposal that Biden has advanced is a binding code of ethics for members of the Supreme Court in the face of this scandal-ridden court we presently have. So that's part of what led to this suggestion. Tell us about it, and what would Biden's proposal entail?
It would require members of the Supreme Court to disclose gifts, refrain from public political activity, and recuse themselves from cases in which they or their spouses have financial or other conflicts of interest. Biden wrote that every other federal judge is bound by an enforceable code of conduct. And this code of ethical conduct would not require a constitutional amendment. I should say that the Supreme Court ethics have become a partisan issue with the ongoing revelations of extravagant gifts that Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito have received. Thomas has received nearly $4.2 million in gifts. Recently, Alito refused to recuse himself from two cases involving Trump and the January 6th Capitol rioters after the New York Times reported that flags associated with far-right causes flew over his family homes. There is a bill pending in the Senate. It's called Supreme Court Ethics Recusal and Transparency Act, S-359, or SCRT, and S-359 would require Supreme Court members, I don't say justices, you notice, I don't think they're justices, would require Supreme Court members to adopt a code of conduct, create a mechanism to investigate alleged violations of the code of conduct and other laws, improve disclosure and transparency when a member has a connection to a party or an amicus brief pending before the court, and require members to explain their recusal decisions to the public.
My goodness, Marjorie, as we know, every presidential election year, a point that is made, depending on who your candidate is, the same point is often made from both sides, that this is going to be a very important presidential election because there may be opportunities to appoint Supreme Court justices and how important that is. In light of what you've said so far, what are the stakes in this particular election for the American people when it comes to, well, the Supreme Court in November and the presidential election?
Well, if Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are elected, Biden's proposed reforms could eventually lead to the reversal of some of the court's most egregious decisions. But the adoption of those reforms faces overwhelming obstacles. Meanwhile, if Trump's elected, he would likely have the backing of the Supreme Court as he implements the Project 2025 agenda. Also, Trump may have the opportunity to replace current members of the court and actually expand the six-member radical supermajority. The liberal Sonia Sotomayor, who is in ill health, could be replaced by a right-winger. And some of the older right-wingers on the court, like 76-year-old Thomas and 74-year-old Alito, could be exchanged for younger members who could wreak havoc for decades to come. So between the makeup of its members and the lack of accountability, the stakes for the Supreme Court are enormous in the forthcoming presidential election.
Marjorie, how can listeners follow your work, and what can they do to support these Supreme Court reforms?
Well, my work is at truthout.org. It's a column called Human Rights and Global Wrongs. If you go down to the very bottom of the page, that my writings, videos, interviews, books, etc., are cataloged at my website, marjoriecohn.com. And I would urge people to contact your senators and congressional representatives and urge them to become co-sponsors on these bills, the ethical code of conduct for Supreme Court members and the term limits bills.
Marjorie, we're so grateful to have you back on Law and Disorder, and for all the work you do every day to alert the American public to these threats to our constitutional democracy and to protect our individual rights. Thank you, Marjorie.
Want to double down on it. We so appreciate your work and joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Well, it's my pleasure, Steve and Jim. Thanks so much.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Israel's deadly and unrelenting assault on Gaza following Hamas's October 7 attack on Israel has had repercussions around the world. In Gaza itself, the death toll is over 40,000, and the humanitarian crisis worsens every day. In the United States, as students are headed back to campus, colleges and universities are bracing for a new round of protests and counter-protests. Israel's war in Gaza is dividing the Democratic Party, just as Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are seeking to unite their party to stop Donald Trump from returning to the White House. Recent surveys show that 48% of Americans oppose Israel's military action in Gaza, while 42% support it. But today on Law and Disorder, instead of the big picture, we're going to take a look at opposition to Israel's war in Gaza from a very personal point of view. We're joined today by Larry Hebert, a very unlikely candidate to become an outspoken protester against U.S. military support for Israel, who would gain national and international attention. Larry Hebert is a 26-year-old U.S. Air Force senior airman and avionics technician assigned to Naval Station Rota in Spain, having served 6 years so far in the military. At 10 a.m. on Easter Sunday, March 31st, 2024, on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House, Hebert began a hunger strike during an authorized leave from his post in Spain. Shortly before his hunger strike, he joined Veterans for Peace, an organization that opposes U.S. military actions. The organization argues that U.S. weapons shipments to Israel is a violation of U.S. law. In a press release issued by Veterans for Peace, the purpose of Hebert's hunger strike was described as highlighting, quote, the plight of the starving children of Gaza, unquote. Hebert wore a sign that read, quote, active duty airman refuses to eat while Gaza starves, unquote, with a photograph of an emaciated Palestinian infant. Hebert said he was inspired by the self-immolation of 25-year-old serviceman Aaron Bushnell, who died on February 25, 2024, outside the Israeli embassy in Washington. Before he died, Bushnell declared he would, quote, no longer be complicit in the genocide in Gaza. Hebert's hunger strike lasted 9 days, but ended abruptly on April 9 when he was ordered to report immediately to Andrews Air Force Base for a return flight to his post in Spain. Hebert is pursuing release from active duty as a conscientious objector. Larry Hebert, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, sir.
To begin with, please tell us about yourself, your upbringing, and your attitudes toward the U.S. military back then when you signed up in 2018.
Yes, so I had a fairly pro-American upbringing. My family is right-wing and love our country and have always been strong supporters of our country and our policy. So I always had a love for this country and a respect for the military, but I never saw myself actually joining the military until I started working at a restaurant and I met a lot of veterans that had already retired and, you know, done their service. And I met people from all the branches, and all of them told me that I could really jumpstart my life and create a really solid foundation going forward if I were to join the military. And then on top of that, of course, all the benefits and the opportunity to travel and learn a trade. So I was obviously very enticed by that. And when, you know, dozens of people are telling you the exact same thing, it's kind of hard not to take that advice. So I joined mostly because of that advice. And then I also had a child on the way. So I figured, you know, working at a dead-end job isn't going to support my family going forward. So that was the real motivation for joining. And I wasn't super like gung-ho and you know, like brainwashed military, but I still had a respect and underlying love for the military.
Well, Larry, this is Jim Lafferty, and it's already been said that you were inspired to take the action you took because of Aaron Bushnell and what he had done by way of killing himself, indeed, in protest of the U.S. support for Israel's war in Gaza. So describe that reaction to us. Tell us more about that reaction that, as I say, ended up inspiring you to take your own protest and your own, in your case, fast for peace.
Yeah, at the time, I was already ready to get out of the military. I thought, however, that I was just going to ride out the remainder of my contract and get out quietly. But in February, when Aaron Bushnell self-immolated, it was kind of like an inspiration. It kind of like reignited like something in me that I knew that, you know, just riding out the remainder of my contract wasn't going to be enough. Like, nobody else was going to step up to the plate and do something. And Aaron Bushnell obviously did that. He stepped up and really led this charge for service members to be speaking out. Ultimately, I waited to see what was going to be the response from the government and then within the military. Basically, both sides remained quiet about the entire situation. I was shown a letter from a representative, I believe Tom Cotton, and it was addressed to the Secretary of Defense, Austin Lloyd. I can't remember the exact verbiage, but he was basically asking him why he wasn't addressing extremism within the ranks. And I found it kind of ironic because the extremists aren't the ones that want an end to violence and an end to war. The extremists are the ones that continue violence and continue warfare and profit from it. I couldn't just sit there and just allow them to just not speak on Aaron and not highlight what he did and why he did it. So I went to DC pretty much immediately after about 2 weeks, and I met with organizations like Code Pink, Veterans for Peace, kind of figure out what I was going to do. I thought maybe talking to politicians might help, and that did not give me any sort of satisfaction. They're just kind of, you know, a one-line media talking points, so that was unsuccessful. And then I got to a breaking point where I thought I would ultimately have to do something enormous for media to even bother to cover it. I talked to a lot of good people that advised me, and I ultimately ended up coming up with a hunger strike, which I had done no research for previously. And I mostly was inspired to do that because of all the news articles that were coming out about the starvation that was happening in Gaza.
Larry, you mentioned Veterans for Peace. Had you known of the group before? Did you learn more about them in this connection? Tell us about the organization and what they stand for and what role they played in your decision to go to Washington.
Yeah, I had no prior knowledge of any veterans organizations prior to going to DC. So I was actually introduced to them prior to my hunger strike by former Colonel Ann Wright. She got me connected to Veterans for Peace and ultimately connected me with pretty much everyone I know. She was a really guiding force when